Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. We very much appreciate your time and attention. And we'll depart from the usual format in our first segment today to share the findings of a long and thorough investigation by Emily Cureton of JPR News. When Emily joined us as Exchange producer nearly a year ago, she was already working on an examination of domestic violence in Del Norte County, where she was working for the Triplicate newspaper in Crescent City. So you'll hear her three radio reports, followed by a brief visit with Emily about her findings. So to start, tracking domestic violence is difficult, more so in rural areas. And in Del Norte County, these calls come into law enforcement agencies at a rate 2.5 times that of anywhere else in the state. Here's the first of the three reports by Emily Cureton on domestic violence in California's remote Northwest.
The calls come in every day.
Female reports that her boyfriend has a baseball bat swinging around. She's afraid of him.
It's late, about 1 in the morning, when this one reaches a dispatcher for the Del Norte County Sheriff's Office.
This time the female has locked herself in her room. Male subject is still outside.
More than an hour later, deputies reach a home on the outskirts of the sprawling county near its southern border with Humboldt. They've been called to deal with 27-year-old Joshua Musser, a man with a history of domestic violence.
Copy. Is he inside the residence or outside?
He may be inside now, but she said she is feeling better. She's got herself locked in her room. I told her to call back if she gets more concerned.
Hours later, the same woman calls back. Again, Musser is not arrested, and a couple of months later, the scene repeats. This time, an arrest leads to probation and fines, the same sentence he's gotten before for assaulting her. Another woman called 911 about Musser 4 years ago. The cops took pictures of her body, showing the choke marks on her neck, the fresh bruises on her face, and the tears in her clothing. She declined medical care. She said she'd handle the situation on her own. A lot of women try to handle abuse alone. Kristen is 29, lives in Crescent City, and she's not using her real name. She describes her latest boyfriend and father of her two kids.
He tried to choke me. He tried to gouge my eye out one time. I left a fingernail because he bit my finger. It was bad. It was so bad. He's pistol whipped me in the head. I should have gotten stitches. I didn't go because, I don't know. It wouldn't have mattered. And I would be scared to leave him.
Only 1 in 10 women victimized by a violent intimate will seek professional medical treatment, according to the U.S. Bureau of Justice statistics. Kristen says that in her experience, reporting just leads to more abuse. Jody Hoon says secrecy is typical. Hoon is a longtime advocate for domestic violence victims in Del Norte County.
And 75% goes unreported. So I'm thinking it's a huge epidemic.
Del Norte County Sheriff Eric Apperson says he and his deputies know this.
We typically aren't involved the first time it happens or the second time it happens. So there's this long-standing history, and a lot of times the victim or the survivor in this situation, they struggle to believe that law enforcement is actually going to help them.
Yet lately, the calls flood in 8 times faster than they did just 5 years ago, while the resources to answer them have dwindled. Take the sheriff's office, where staffing has declined by nearly a third in recent years. Del Norte District Attorney Dale Trigg says this high turnover has a ripple effect.
It's difficult, and it has consequences.
Trigg says arrest reports often reach his office weeks after an offender has been released from jail. That means fewer arrests lead to charges.
And it's not always a law enforcement issue. In fact, usually it's not. The facts are what they are. If you go out to a scene and you contact a woman who has injuries and she won't tell you how she got those injuries, you can't just figure, well, I know how you got them and I'm going to arrest so-and-so for doing it. I mean, the officers can't do anything about that.
Trigg says all the officers can do is to try to get the truth out of people. But Sheriff Eric Apperson explains how laws have changed to shift responsibility away from victim statements.
You know, now in California, if you can establish what's legally defined as a primary aggressor, then you're required to make an arrest.
On average, though, less than 20% of Del Norte's 911 domestic violence calls lead to arrest. Apperson says most times victims may want to talk, but...
You know, they don't want to go through the clinical part of, let me see the bruise and let's move this article of clothing so I can hold a ruler up to it and we can take a picture.
But Melody, a 21-year-old woman who spent her teens in Del Norte, says shame isn't the only thing breeding silence.
People often blame the victim because they don't realize how hard it is to talk about stuff like that. And they say if you're not going to report it, then it's basically your fault. But I was afraid that it would get worse.
Melody's not her real name. She was once homeless and usually avoided police. Still, she tried to report more than one sexual assault.
And the cops, they just weren't very nice to me because I wouldn't give them too many details. It was too hard for me. It's still really hard for me to talk about that.
Eventually, Melody got help. Now she has a job and a place to live. But leaving town and starting over aren't always options. And sometimes, reporting abuse can make things worse. Emily Curitan, JPR News.
So Emily's series is called The Aftermath, if you're just joining us on the Jefferson Exchange. And Del Norte Triplicate writer David Greeter contributed to the report, which was supported by a California Health Journalism Fellowship. In the second of three parts, Emily Curitan brings us the story of one family's struggle to escape a toxic legacy.
It's a sunny October morning near the mouth of the Klamath River when a Del Norte County Sheriff's deputy flips on his body camera. He's in front of a two-story house on the Yurok Tribe's reservation, met by a 30-year-old man named Cliff Moorhead. Moorhead denies wrongdoing. He says his wife's emotions are out of control, and that's why a passerby called 911.
She's upset right now, and she's really emotional.
The deputy leaves Moorhead with his partner and goes up to the house. 26-year-old Tara Williams opens the door.
Hi, Tara.
Hello.
Can I step inside and talk? What's going on today?
I don't know.
I don't know becomes a refrain through her sobs. She says they aren't married, but have three kids together. She says she's scared. The deputy goes through the questions, the ones he's required to ask victims of domestic violence.
Did he hold you against your will inside or any point? He did?
I didn't necessarily want to leave. I just wanted to go outside and get away from the situation.
Okay. And he wouldn't let you outside?
The deputy asks if she wants a ride to the shelter. She says no, not again. He asks if she's hurt. She says no. He repeatedly asks if she wants a court protective order. She says she doesn't know. She doesn't mention she's gotten one of those before. The kids upstairs turn up the TV as the deputy is about to leave.
Take a minute before I leave here. I'll ask you again if you want an emergency protective order.
I'm just kind of scared of, the retaliation.
He'll be going to jail.
But when he gets out, he's really mad.
Well, all right.
The deputy shrugs and goes back outside. He asks Moorhead to turn around.
You're under arrest for false imprisonment.
For false imprisonment?
That's correct.
The deputy goes back inside. He says Moorhead will be in jail for the day, probably the whole weekend, and that they'll go to court on Monday. But Moorhead bails out of jail within 5 hours. That court date is set a month after the crimes allegedly occurred. By that time, Tara Williams was dead.
I think it was probably about 500 people at her funeral.
This is Sandy Schwenk. Tara Williams called her Kuchos, the Yurok word for grandmother. You can see a bend in the Klamath from her cabin along its northern bank. She points to an outdoor table where her granddaughter used to fillet salmon caught from the river.
And when her dad and her mom would go fishing, they'd bring fish here and we'd process it out here and put it in that smokehouse right here.
After Tara grew up and started her own family with Moorhead, Schwenk says she noticed the bruises and the lies to cover them.
I said, Tara, what happened? She said, oh, I fell, Kuchos. I fell down the stairs. I said, it looks like it. And she knew that I knew. I'd ask her any questions. She would avoid the subject. And if I start to say something, she would say something first to keep me from asking that question.
Between Tara's death and her funeral, the charges against Moorhead were dropped. Cliff Moorhead didn't respond to requests for comment. The district attorney later described him as a man with no history of domestic violence. But Moorhead does have a history. Restraining orders, civil complaints, and alleged assault spanning many years. Not one resulting in criminal charges. Until that October arrest for false imprisonment. The day after those charges are filed, Moorhead calls to report Tara missing. The next day, Moorhead reports finding her body near a wrecked pickup off a lonely stretch of Highway 101. It's nearly dusk when that 911 call reaches a dispatcher.
Missing person case, and this is a missing person vehicle. He's advising us over the embankment, search and rescue's en route.
As word spreads, Tara's family begins to gather on the rain-slicked curve of road. The California Highway Patrol begins to investigate her death. The investigation recreates a pickup truck skidding and flipping down a hill between the highway and the ocean. Unseatbelted, Tara's body is launched through a broken window. She lands a good distance from where trees stop the truck. Her cell phone is found right beside her hands. CHP says her phone records haven't been obtained. In the weeks that followed, some of her friends suspected suicide. Philip Williams says, no way.
She had so much to live for at that moment.
Williams is Tara's father. He recognizes that domestic violence affected his daughter long before she met Moorhead.
Because I was always been a tough guy when I was young. I used to fight a lot. I used to be involved in violence.
He says he used to hate himself and wonder how he could inflict abuse on his wife after seeing his own mother beaten. Then he got treatment. He thinks this is part of why his daughter tolerated an abusive partner.
She's seen her dad change, and I believe that she thought Cliff could change. She was waiting for the day when they were going to turn the corner and they were going to be who she had in her dreams.
William says he's not yet the man he aspires to be, but thanks to his daughter, he's better than who he was. Emily Curitan, JPR News.
Emily is now the producer of the Jefferson Exchange and had begun the work on this reporting project when we met her about a year ago. So she brought all the material over to the Jefferson Exchange with her, to JPR News. Del Norte Triplicate writer David Greeter contributed to the report, which is supported by a California Health Journalism Fellowship. It's called The Aftermath, Domestic Violence in Rural Northern California. We'll get into the final part of the series now before we get to talk to Emily live. Native communities are disproportionately affected by high rates of domestic violence, while state-led interventions in these communities are often costly and ineffective. In rural California, the state's Department of Health and Human Services says the solutions require a cultural shift that entire communities must take responsibility for ending violence against women. So in the final part of the series, Emily Curitan reports on how new programs on the ancestral lands of the Yurok tribe are trying to do just that.
It's been a while since I've been up here.
Lori Nesbitt trudges up a hill overlooking the ocean, her back to the mouth of the Klamath River below. She works with people experiencing domestic violence, and it's been a long day.
Today didn't go as planned. The women didn't show up.
These women were supposed to show up for Nesbitt's domestic violence intervention program. The idea is for perpetrators to listen to each other and learn what triggers abusive behavior. But when nobody shows up to the group...
That's contagious.
Contagious because the program is peer-driven. There's a women's group run by Nesbitt and a men's group run by a male Yurok tribal probation officer. Most people in the groups were ordered to attend by a judge in the hopes that they'll buy into treatment rather than merely accepting punishment. But that's a big shift in perspective.
I stopped asking defendants, why did you do that? Many people don't understand why they get into a behavior that they themselves do not like.
That's Yurok Chief Justice Abby Abinanti, head of the reservation's court system, which runs the intervention program. She says one way to understand the high rate of domestic violence among her people is to look at history.
You have intergenerational trauma where you have a history that is not pleasant between us and other cultures, where you have massacres, where you had people carried off to boarding schools, and where you have a tremendous amount of poverty. All those things are breeding grounds for behaviors that are not acceptable in community.
Community is a word Abinanti uses a lot. She says the whole approach of her court is based on restoring relationships.
And that's hugely different than create consequences for behavior in the hopes that somehow that deters the behavior.
So if punishment doesn't work, what will?
You create access to programming that does not make them have to be found guilty first. It makes them have to say, hey, I don't want to do this. I want my children to see me differently. I want my grandchildren to see me differently.
The intervention program is one way the Yurok tribe is trying to cultivate that mindset throughout a community grown accustomed to domestic violence. But if people don't buy into the program, it doesn't work. And Vicki Bates says there's already too much to worry about.
People just can't survive, and to get their medical needs taken care of and to eat, they're stuck. If they don't have a ride or don't have a friend that has a ride, then they're stuck.
Bates gives a lot of rides. She's a domestic violence crisis worker through the tribe's Justice Center.
They're hard people to help because they don't have vehicles, they don't have phone services. How can you help them? So we get them a bag of emergency supplies together, and hopefully they have that if they have to run down the road.
Bates says she spends a lot of time in the car, taking clients to medical or court appointments or to the nearest grocery store, a 45-mile round trip from the reservation. Then at the end of each day, she's got more people to take care of.
So when I leave at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock or whatever hour I leave, sometimes it's later than that. Sometimes it's been up to 9 and 10 o'clock. I have to make sure I shrug my shoulders off and go home to my family.
Bates is a mother, grandmother, and a single parent. At her house on the reservation, kids bounce around as she talks about the ways domestic violence has affected her. She says she wants the kids to hear about her life, which hasn't been easy. She was married to an abusive spouse by 16. Now she's in her 50s and wants to teach her kids an openness that her parents never had.
I don't know. It was just too busy. There was too many kids. There was always something going on. Family trauma, deaths, kids falling apart. And we were just kind of breezing through all of that, not dealing with, hey, let's plan for tomorrow. It was more like, let's try and save today. Let's try and help whoever's broken today and move on. No, I don't know why that made me emotional. Probably because she walked in.
One of Vicky's granddaughters strides into the room.
I'm Kaypoon, and it means winter in Yurok.
Kaypoon's 10. She says she wants to be a singer when she's older.
I've been working on my voice.
When offered a microphone, she goes for it.
I wanna shout. I wanna scream to the woods, dry out. So put in all of the papers, I'm not afraid.
Her voice carries through the house, another home where domestic violence has left behind scars, but not silence. Emily Curitan, JPR News.
I want to point out again, Del Norte Triplicate writer David Greeter contributed to this report, which was supported by a California Health Journalism Fellowship. Emily Curitan, now the producer of the Jefferson Exchange and here in the studio with me. You were working on this a year ago when we first met you, so it's been a very, very long process. How different is what's going on in Del Norte County from any other county in California? Is this really outsized?
By the numbers, yes. The rate of calls for assistance with domestic violence, that's the technical term, and one way of tracking a very difficult thing to track. That rate in Del Norte County is two, or was the latest year that all of the counties have been tabulated, is 2014. And in that year, Del Norte was 2.5 times the rate of the next nearest county. So that means that for every 1,000 calls to 911, 45 of them are actually 46 in Del Norte involved domestic violence. The next nearest county, Glenn County, that's 18 out of 1,000 calls involved domestic violence. The state average in California is about 6 per 1,000 calls.
Wow. So way, way, way above. This is not just like a slightly above. This is like many times what the average is.
Yeah, many times.
Does anybody have a firm fix, Emily, on whether it's more cases or more people coming forward?
That is definitely a point of debate. As you mentioned, I began working with these ideas about a year ago. I was working at the Del Norte Triplicate as a staff writer and actually on the police beat for a little while at that point, and listened to a scanner on my desk. And I had a sense that these calls were definitely coming in every day. And then there wasn't really, there still isn't a mechanism for tracking them as a distinct class of crime. It's kind of like we just check the box when the call comes in and move on with our lives. So I've heard some advocates say, people who work in the only emergency shelter in the county, it's about 1,000 square miles, highly rural. People there told me, yes, we are seeing more people. This is definitely increasing. However, if more people are actually calling police, that's a good thing. We should be celebrating this high rate. Because, you know, only, say, 6 years ago in 2010, Del Norte County's 911 dispatchers logged 133 calls pertaining to domestic violence. This last year, 2015, they got 1,146 calls. So that's a huge increase. And part of the real bear in this reporting was the information tracking systems used by law enforcement, by service providers, by court systems, by tribal entities. Everybody has their own way of keeping track of domestic violence interventions or crises. And those did not overlay in an apples to oranges kind of way. So this one number of calls per assistance, was the sort of launch pad for the series.
You described in the series the efforts to get people to make use of preventive services, which they sometimes do not or cannot show up to use. But given the caseload, particularly in Del Norte County, are there enough services to go around?
Well, that's a judgment call. I would say the short answer is no. You know, one of the programs we talk about in the third story there, the Batterers Intervention Program, the Yurok tribe has created a more culturally sensitive version of that, but it's a state model, and it's often assigned to offenders in lieu of jail time. And the waiting list for a couple of people I spoke to who had been either sentenced or were in a child protective intervention situation, they'd been on the waiting list to get into a program like that for months when I talked to them. So there are many more people being sentenced to treatment for domestic violence than there are treatment programs for them.
And it seems like the emerging approach now is somewhat counterintuitive. It's not a lock them up and throw away the key kind of idea, but the idea of rather than isolating or shunning people, either abusers or victims, to let them know they're part of a community, as Judge Abby Abinante said. Has there been much resistance to the approach?
It's a nice idea, isn't it? I think that you're walking a line there. One thing that came up over and over again, and that I think as a whole, perhaps in my reporting, is why is this happening? Why are people abusing their own family members? Why do people who are abused then go on to do it again? And stress was mentioned over and over. And I think maybe this community building, and there's plenty of examples of it and positive examples of it in Del Norte County. One of the big stresses is money. Not to say that everybody who's experiencing these things has money problems, but for example, the batterer's intervention program, the cost of that actually falls on the accused or the convicted, and it's about $1,100 or more for the whole program. The average annual income of someone convicted of Del Norte County is about $12,000, according to a 2012 study. So that's a huge hit, and people say, the advocates say, that that adds more stress to the household and actually can make things worse.
You know, Del Norte is certainly the remote corner of California, but still part of California, wealthy state. Any discussion of money coming from Sacramento to help augment what's going on there?
Well, one interesting thing I found in my reporting, and this is just one funding stream, but the California Victim Witness Compensation Government Control Board, that's an entity that redistributes restitution payments made to the courts by people convicted of crimes, and they go to crime victims across the state. This money, if you're a crime victim, you can apply for it, usually through a local office. In Del Norte County, I found the amount of money coming in over the last 6 years as the domestic violence rate was increasing had dropped by 90%.
Really?
Yeah.
So the pieces have now aired. Well, we still have one left to air on the music services here in JPR, but our audience here heard them all. They've also been appearing in the Triplicate in Crescent City. What kind of reactions are you getting from people?
When the story came out in print in the Del Norte Triplicate, I gauged a number of local reactions. I had a number of women email me or contact me to share their stories. On Facebook, there was quite a row because I did basically accuse someone who's never been convicted of a crime. One woman's question really stuck with me. She said, you know, it's so important to get these things out there, but I have mixed feelings about the reporting because I wouldn't want something written like that about me.
Well, it's been thorough and complete work and well done, Emily. Thanks for bringing it to the Jefferson Exchange and to JPR News.
Thank you, Jeffrey.